Welcome to Conductor's Brew. Matt,
Larry.
It's good to be back with you, and it's exciting. We are in the front yard. No more Zoom. No more random travels across God knows where in the Northern Hemisphere with this crew.
Yeah, what'd you do, like 3,000 miles in the last month or so at least?
No.
I don't know.
Something like that.
Cross country to an undisclosed location.
Cross country, doing it COVID style was just crazy. Like, I think I mentioned the other episode, you know, we went and we would stay in hotels and we would, you know.
Happy New Year, by the way.
Happy New Year to you. Yes, it's the brand new year. But this whole, you know, traveling in the time of COVID to be safe. And then when we got to our destination in quarantining for 2 weeks, where Cindy and I didn't see anybody. I mean, well, we saw at a distance outside. We didn't interact with anybody for 2 weeks and stayed in this one guest room. We'd go outside and sit on the patio like 12 feet apart to talk and stuff like that. It was just nuts. But we
better than nothing, though.
Right. We wanted to be very safe. You know, we wanted to do this in a real safe way because we take very seriously what's going on. But it was crazy. But it is really good to be back in Utah. It's good to be back with you. It's good to be back with proper winter temperatures.
You know, it's just like a searing 40 degrees outside.
It's beautiful, though.
It's sunny.
Yeah.
The inversion's bad.
All right. Don't just spoil it for me.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's the only thing about living in Salt Lake I don't like is the inversion.
Yeah.
It's the inversion.
You know, I've been trying to get out more in the winter and started snowshoeing just, I think, last year or the year before, which I love. It's fantastic. Great way to stay in shape for the hiking season, too, once the snow melts. But I did a couple of really awesome hikes in the last month since we've last done one of these in person. Yeah. Went out into the desert a few weeks ago, just before Christmas, actually, not to Pilot Peak on, I guess that's the Nevada side of the border, but just before that, in the Great Salt Lake Desert, there's this range of mountains, kind of runs from I-80 near West Wendover.
Is that where Deseret Peak is?
No, it's past that.
Okay.
So we've got the Wasatch Range here, right?
Yeah.
And that's like the big range that all the ski resorts are on. Ski and snowboard, I stand corrected.
Not at Alta, though.
No.
That's a whole other show. Okay.
You know, I was watching some old commercial. I've been having a hard time sleeping, so I've been watching skiing, like skiing videos that people put GoPros on their helmets or whatever.
Oh, wow.
And it's very relaxing. But I
All right. Wouldn't have thought that, but okay.
I saw one video. Did you know snowboards are like relatively new?
Yes, I had no idea. Yeah.
This is like a video from the 80s where I think somebody at one of the resorts, one of the ski patrol guys, was just livid about these snowboarders climbing up to the top of the mountain and getting in the way with their snowboards, where you didn't even have straps then on the snowboards. They were just like a surfboard. They were little straps that you kind of not well they don't you don't ratchet them on, you just kind of stick your foot in it.
Yeah, you
and
stick
hope
your
you
foot
stay.
And it clamps it down.
Yeah, no, there was no clamp on
but
it
no
at
clamp
all. Yeah, not clamped down. And this guy is like, look, they're dangerous for everybody, they're hazardous to our health. We just want to send the message that we don't want them ever.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, I wonder what this guy's saying now, because that clearly was not successful.
Well,
but Alta is the holdout.
This whole snowboard ski thing conversation could get us in danger in Utah.
Yes.
It can be a hot topic for some. But,
yes.
It definitely is the newer thing. But I don't do a ton of skiing, but I enjoy skiing, not snowboarding. I've never saw what the problem was with it.
I don't either.
I mean, skiers, in my opinion,
can be just as dangerous.
If you're all sliding downhill on pieces of wood or plastic,
At great speed. Without brakes.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, anyway, that's all to say that there's no controversy surrounding the fact that the Wasatch Mountains are just gorgeous.
That's true.
So that's there.
And we can all agree on that.
The next, the next west is the Ochre Mountains, which are a lot of private property up there, so they're hard to hike.
Yeah, copper mine.
Yep.
Yeah.
Kennecott,
not
too,
a lot of trails.
And also, further to the west then is the Stansberry Range. That's where Deseret is.
Okay.
Just under 11,000 feet. I can't remember. And then you go past the Utah Test and Training Range, which is operated by Dugway Proving Grounds, and that's on the south side of I-80, which is just straight. I mean, straighter than anything for about 10 to 12 miles. I mean, you can literally see the horizon at the end of the road out in front of you. It's just flatter than anything.
Yeah.
And then to the north of that road is the Hill Air Force Base Range, which leads me into the the thrust of the story.
Okay.
Which is kind of an intended pun, because we hiked the high point of the Silver Island Mountains. And as soon as we got out there, the drive is crazy, by the way. These old dirt roads that are just like overcome with sand and mm-hmm. salt. But once we get out there, we hear this rumble and we're like, what is that? And we look up, and out of nowhere come these two big jets, military jets, relatively low to the ground, come right over the mountain we're about to climb, and then go straight up.
Oh, cool.
Straight up with, you know, full thrust. And yeah. It was like the loudest thing I've ever heard.
Oh, I bet.
It was.
Well, that's why they do it way out there.
Yeah.
Thankfully, they don't do that above the Salt Lake Valley.
Yeah, thankfully. I mean, I was shouting to be heard.
Oh, my God.
Yes, yeah.
Well, I grew up in Carter County, North Carolina. And there's a base there called Bogue Field. It was where they would practice doing aircraft carrier landings and takeoffs.
Oh, wow.
And that's, I think it was the main purpose of the whole thing.
Place the field and go.
Right. And so I've actually toured it when I was a kid, a Boy Scout. And they have the cable where the tail hook would be, you know, they grab it when they land.
Oh, yeah.
So they're constantly just doing touch and goes or whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
And they would be pretty low because it was not far from the house. And one time I looked up and I could read, like, U.S. Navy on the side. And I'm like, man.
Too close.
I live here, man. Come on. But anyway, but they had
the way in at least, right?
But they had the point of my story is they had this sign out that says, "Pardon our noise, it's the sound of freedom." So I'm like, okay, well, I do appreciate a robust aircraft carrier prowling the seas and protecting us. So yes. I'm okay with that. But good. So you got some hiking in. That's very good.
Got some great hiking in.
And what else? You're just sort of hanging out. In the
I've been sampling a lot of very interesting coffee.
Of
I've
course,
I've got a lot more to share.
All right.
However, today we are recording in the relative mid to late afternoon.
Yes.
So
for
we
warmth.
Opted to go for in the warmth, the heat of the day,
out of the
scorching 40 degrees.
Yeah.
We opted to go with something a little less caffeinated, and we are drinking green tea.
Ah, yes.
This is one that my brother actually introduced to me. My brother's also a musician, a fantastic pianist, and he and I, we have the shared passion of tea, and we have traded back and forth our recommendations and reviews for years now, which is a lot of fun. And he recommended this to me. It's called Silver Strands, and usually when I talk coffee, I describe like the scent or the aroma of the coffee and whatnot.
Talking about umami and all kinds
of stuff. Exactly. But now I can tell you about the color of the tea. It's loose leaf tea, which is like, it's a whole other thing. If you're not used to drinking loose leaf tea and you just drink tea bags, you're like, why is he describing the tea? I don't care. Just tell me what it tastes like. No, it's
brown, right?
It's real. It's real high quality tea is not usually brown. It's usually green or a variation of thereof if it's green tea, or a kind of like oxidized black. It can be like a deep brown, but they're whole pieces. They're not, you know, whole leaves that have been rolled up or crushed or something. It's not the leftover dust from the processing that you get in a tea bag, which is literally what's in a tea bag. It's just the leftover low-grade dustings, they call them, from the tea processing. So anyway, this tea, it comes in these beautiful strands of silvery, well, as the name implies, silvery gray green, ranging anywhere from almost a white to a deep green brown. And when you stick them in hot water, which, by the way, needs to be no more than 175 degrees Fahrenheit.
I remember from Alton Brown.
He had a show called Goodies. I love Alton Brown.
Yeah,
I'm constantly adapting his recipes.
Yeah, I figured you would be a fan of that because you like to do things by not necessarily by the book, with science.
It's my Virgo nature, I think.
Yeah, man. Yeah. You don't, no half measures with Manella. But anyway, he talked about I don't know if it was black tea or green tea, but one, you take the water to the pot, and one, you take the pot to the water because of the difference in temperature that will happen if you pick up the kettle and I guess walk across the kitchen to the teapot versus taking the teapot over to the stove and doing it right there. And so he had this whole thing. I mean, if I'm remembering correctly.
You're correct.
Okay.
It's actually the act of, you see this a lot I think I saw this on a show about Japanese tea or something where they actually, it's called pulling the tea, P-U-L-L, pull, where you actually take water or any liquid from hot liquid from one container and pour it into another container or vessel, and actually doing it back and forth several times to achieve a certain temperature, because doing that from the boiling point, you can calculate literally how much degrees of temperature you're losing between pores.
Wow. And
so yeah, there's something like 2 or 3 degrees, or I think up to 5 degrees per pore, you're actually decanting or pulling the tea enough where it's interacting, you know, with the air and warming up the other vessel that that actually lowers the temperature. So bringing the boiling water to another vessel, letting it cool off a little bit, and then adding tea, which is what I did today, helps ensure that it's at the you know, lower temperature than right off the boil, which is like 200 and something degrees, which is too hot.
And you want it, so you, and if I'm remembering correctly, generally speaking, green tea, you want the water a little cooler than black tea.
Correct. The lighter the tea, the lower the temperature.
Okay.
Yeah. So black tea, you can do right off the, you can brew it right off the boil.
Yeah.
I usually don't. I like to infuse my tea a few times. When you have good tea, you can just keep pouring hot water on it all day. Mm-hmm. It's great. And I try to avoid the bitterness. The whole point of using lower temperature, not boiling water, is to avoid bitter notes in the tea. And so the fresher teas, because green tea is less processed than black tea. Black tea is literally just the same plant that's been rubbed so it oxidizes and gets black.
Right. I think we talked about this on a previous episode.
The less processed it is, the more delicate it is, meaning the hotter water you add to the tea, the more chances you have of extracting too many of the more stringent notes, the more stringent flavors. Yeah, because they're present there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for this, I would opt for like 160, 165 degrees, and then each time I infuse it again, I'll increase the temperature a little bit just to keep extracting it.
Wow, man.
And white tea, I'll start even lower, 140, 145, 150, to get the really kind of floral notes. Speaking of which, this tea out of the jar when it's unbrewed, dry tea, smells like fresh hay.
Oh.
It smells lovely. Would you like to smell this?
I would. I would. All right. Wow, you know it does.
Yeah, it's sweet. It smells sweet.
I am. It's been a while since I've hung out with hay, but we would use hay when we would go camping as a kid. I think for like bedding on the ground. And,
yeah. Oh, I love that smell.
Yeah.
Tasting it, I don't know. What would you? Ooh. What do you think, Larry? I've got a description I can read. I've also got my own opinion, of course.
Yeah. Nothing is particularly standing out. I do. It's certainly more complex flavor than the I do the tea bags, man. Yeah. I gotta say, you know me.
I know.
I'm the antithesis.
Hey, it's convenient. There's nothing wrong with it. But it's a matter of preference.
Here's the thing: is I do appreciate it, and I appreciate the effort that you put in. But no, it definitely has a more complex flavor, and I do taste some kind of florally-ness to it. Yeah.
Yeah, I do too. It almost smells a bit like roses.
Yeah.
Or something.
I can see that.
It's kind of pungent.
Mm-hmm.
It's got kind of a kick to it, and it's got that sort of savoriness at the end there, where it sort of makes your mouth pucker, sort of like a glass of red wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. Those are the tannins, kind of the umami. This particular tea, well, tea grows on trees.
Fair enough.
It's a more robust tea than other green teas, which are usually a little bit lighter, a little bit more floral. It's beautiful because it tastes like your typical green tea. It's kind of like a nice middle ground tea that it is a bit more complex than like tea bag tea, I guess. But it also isn't really that complex at the same time. So it's kind of a nice all day beverage because you can just drink it and it's super good for you. And it gives you kind of a nice light little caffeine buzz. It's just super pleasant. So that's the brew of the day, the Silver Strands Green Tea.
And an excellent, afternoon tea.
Yeah.
And from where?
China. Oh, Yunnan. Okay.
Yeah.
Yunnan province? Is that a province?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It is. It is a province. I think, is that where Bo,
our friend Bo, lives? I was just going to ask. Shout out to our colleague, Bo.
Yeah.
Wu Bo.
Yeah, Wu Bo. And I think he lives in Hunan. I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Yes.
Bo can email me.
I remember I remember hearing from him early in the epidemic, and he was like right in the middle of it.
Yeah, well, he lives in Wuhan.
I'll have to get in touch with him. Maybe have him on the show via Skype.
Would be good. We have to find a time when he's not in the middle of his night there, or whatever.
Yeah, but us, you know.
But true enough,
we might have to get up really early or something, and it would be really late there. What's the time difference in China? Depends.
I
want to
say it's around 12 hours.
Okay,
but I might be off on that a few hours. But anyway, we'll work it out. We should definitely have Bo on the show. And also we should have Claudia on the show too.
I agree.
We should get that. And that is a good segue into our topic of the day. Because when I was in school with Claudia and Beau, we did Charles Ives' Unanswered Question. And the topic of today's show is all about American music. And we are both Americans. That's a good one good reason to talk about it.
Indeed.
But it's also something that I think a lot of people in the orchestral music world especially don't talk or don't get into as much of, especially kind of the earlier stuff, like pre-Aaron Copland. And we're going to talk about Copland a lot, stuff like that. But I think it's somebody like Charles Ives has just such a wonderful amount of orchestral rep that I just think needs to get done more. Unanswered Question, of course, is for small orchestra. It's for strings and flutes. Or actually, he's pretty flexible. If you look at the score, the trumpet part, which is the solo part, it could be, I think he says, it could be English horn or clarinet or even oboe or something like that. So it's being flexible. But, you know, just tons of good orchestral rep that comes out of the earlier tradition. So that's kind of what I wanted to get in with a little bit today. I teach a class in American music history. It's one of my favorite subjects to teach. And I feel that it's something, especially the early days, that you know, people should delve into. So, and when we're talking about American music, at least I'm talking about it, I'm sort of looking at it from the vantage point of the earliest composers of the first New England school.
Okay.
William Billings, folks like that. And then kind of, you know, as and seeing that evolution through the 19th century, and then by the time the 20th century comes out, and we having Ives and Copland, it's quite a journey in terms of what happens in America. So anyway, that's our topic for the day.
First American school.
First New England school.
First New England school.
Yeah,
thank you.
First New England school. And so these were the composers of the singing school movement. And so what the singing school was is it actually was an effort by New England ministers, I think primarily New England ministers, to try and improve the singing of congregations and churches. And so they wanted to give music instruction to their congregation members. And so they came up with these ideas of singing schools, and these composers and music teachers would travel around the country, and they would teach these classes where they would, you know, gather everybody together in the church or the meeting hall, and they'd teach lessons, and they do some, I guess, basic music theory kind of stuff. And then they'd move on. And as part of this, they would write these books. I think they called them, the Singing School Master or something. I don't know. But they had names. And in it, all these compositions, these represent sort of the first real American music compositions after starting with the colonial period.
Otherwise known as Yankee Tunesmiths.
Yankee Tunesmiths, right. And I love that name, right? And you're a Yankee Tunesmith.
I am
Matt.
A Yankee Tunesmith.
Yes, you are, my
By
friend.
By birth.
That's right. Claim your heritage, my friend. But yeah, it had this kind of like craftsman like attitude as opposed to like, you know, highfalutin European music. It was like robust. And it was kind of rough around the edges kind of music.
Well, I should modify this. I'm not strictly a Yankee Tunesmith, who I think were largely self-taught, because I had some excellent teachers along the way.
That's true.
Who were also, some of them were Yankees as well. So maybe I honestly don't know what my composition lineage is like.
Yeah,
I looked into the conducting one, but not the composition one.
You can just call yourself that, man. Just own it. Whatever you want.
I kind of like that.
But yeah, but these were guys mostly self-taught, and they would make like what quote unquote mistakes in voice leading and stuff like that. If you're looking at the style, the European style, but it was just really, you know, organic vernacular kind of a music tradition that develops, and it's, you know, it's based of course on European religious music, Protestant religious music, the Psalters, these books that came over from the Protestant traditions from Europe and particularly Switzerland and can't remember else, but anyway, but they had this tradition. But then these singing school masters started writing their own stuff and expanding on this. And one of the earliest or one of the most famous pieces from this early period is Chester. Do you know Chester?
Yeah,
da, 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 there you go. Da, dee, 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 dee. That's William Billings, and then of course, and there's the William Schumann.
Great arrangement.
Yes,
for the band.
That is a really cool piece where it's variations, or is it Fantasia on Chester?
What's
it called?
Yeah, something.
Maybe it's
like
just
that.
Called Chester.
Yeah, it's very Ives-ish, if I recall.
Yeah, I think Schumann is definitely taking
an apt comparison. Should I
think so?
Compare the two. Yeah. This is far from my area of expertise, by the way, but I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, there's this inherent bias, I think, in quote unquote Western classically musically trained artists, where if a piece of music doesn't conform to the, again, quote unquote, correct voice leading or theory, that it's somehow bad. And I think that holds back a lot of people from enjoying composers like Ives or some of these early singing school composers,
right,
who weren't really worried about following those rules. They were out to do something not unique necessarily. I'm sure they didn't think of it that way, but they were doing something that was their own. It wasn't copied after this other Western tradition, maybe based in it in terms of its pitches and its scales and all that, but in terms of how the notes go together,
yeah,
all of it was fair game.
Well, if you think of it, kind of getting to my point of this early stuff is you know, William Billings is doing this around the time of the Revolutionary War, right? So he's late 18th century. This is the time of Haydn and Mozart, you know, over in Europe, and so. You know, during this period of time, this is something that's kind of embraced by the population. The big cities in New England, people are singing in church, and they are enjoying it. And a song like Chester gets adapted as a patriotic song. That's the words that we know most today. Let tyrants shake their iron rods and slavery clang or galling chain. I'm not going to sing it. Sorry.
Yeah.
But anyway, and that
it's beautiful, though.
By the way, there's a great miniseries on John Adams, and they're singing that in there. If you're into that. But it's the one with Paul Giamatti playing Adams. But anyway, I digress.
Paul Giamatti.
So this was the music of everybody. This belonged to everybody. And then a generation or so later, around the 19th century, people started looking down their nose at it. And they started saying, oh, well, look, that's just amateur stuff. And in some ways, in many cases it was, these people had other careers.
Yeah.
Because they would do these singing schools, but then they also were tanners and they were coopers. And
Ives is a great example of that, too.
Exactly, and that's...
He was a banker, full-time banker.
Insurance salesman.
Excuse me, insurance salesman.
Similar.
Full-time insurance salesman.
It's a numbers thing, right?
It's a numbers thing.
But anyway, then the generations later, they start looking down their nose at these guys. Oh, this is just blah, you know, and it's, it's you know, make mistakes, and it's not nearly as glorious as Mozart.
It sounds like elitism at its finest.
It is. And so this stuff gets pushed away from the cities, and it gets pushed into the rural areas. But it survives in things like the Sacred Harp and these religious music books that still get used today in more rural Protestant traditions. And the shape note books.
Yes. I was wondering if you were going to mention shape note.
Yeah, shape note. I mean, that's a method of notation and conducting a group of people that comes from this tradition. So we go enter this period. I'm sorry, this is a long exposition.
No, please.
Exposition. So we enter this period in the 19th century where we're very much looking down at this American stuff, and there's so much of an effort to try and just copy the European style. You know, everybody's trying to just sort of sound like a European stuff, and you listen to people. I mean, and it's good music, but you listen to it from this like 19th century, early mid 19th century generation, and it kind of just sounds like European music. But by Americans. There's nothing kind of American about it. It doesn't have that kind of flavor to it. I don't mean to like dominate here.
No, this is fantastic. I have a lot to think about, and also I'm wondering how this is maybe opening a can of worms that we don't want to get to quite yet, or
is
it a topic for another day, but how are we defining an American sound?
This is what we're getting at.
Okay.
So I think it's Virgil Thompson who said, "What you know? How do you compose an American? How do you compose American music?" And he's like, "Be an American and write music."
I'm paraphrasing. Yeah,
I think it was Virgil Thompson. Yeah. I don't know, but anyway, I'm not sure.
So well, then let me make a distinction between American composers and American or any composer writing American nationalist music.
Yes.
So what makes then American nationalist music nationalist?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Or quote-unquote representative of American culture.
Yeah,
or nationalist.
Well, I think that's what we're going to get into today. We're going to kind of talk about that, because this is the question. Like, I think you would look at someone like Billings and say, yeah, it comes from a European tradition, but the American experience has influenced the music, and you can hear in the music, or if you look into it, the influence of the American experience, which was these singing schools, right? Okay. So I think that's when you start saying, well, what is a unique feature of this country, and how is that reflected in the music? Okay. That's, to me, is what makes it American. When I listen to somebody who, like John Knowles Payne, for example, who is later in the 19th century, or Arthur Heinrich? I don't know. But anyway, he was also an American. You know, I don't hear anything in there that sort of speaks to an American experience that's least obvious to me. And not everything, but a lot of it.
Oh, that brings to mind another question, but continue.
Yeah, the point is that the question is, like, what sort of gives it an American sound?
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Okay, so I suppose I should go listen. I should have gone and listened to some shape note singing.
Mm-hmm.
Before the show, I'd be curious to hear what that sounds like. A really good, to use a bad word, classic example of shape note singing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd love to find music that incorporates those sounds. That is more, I would say, you know, classical, mm-hmm. traditional Western European.
Yeah, well, I think you have. Yeah, I mean, for sure, there's recordings out there, but a piece like Chester, William yeah. Billings, I mean, that's a great example okay. of one where he takes that style and incorporates it in there.
So go listen to some shape note singing, and then listen to Chester.
Yeah,
and see how those things overlap.
The Schumann version of Chester.
Yeah, Schumann version.
Yeah,
William Schumann, not. Wait, it is is it
William Schumann? Yeah, it's spelled different than Robert.
It is,
but I think it's pronounced. They're both pronounced Schumann.
Okay.
Anyway, but right. So, what is an American sound? So that brings me up to, and then you have the second. It brings me up to Dvorak.
Okay,
right. And we're going to have a whole throwdown about the Ninth Symphony.
Yeah,
I can see it. I can see you coming at me, but you have to stay 6 feet away. So,
is it me staring daggers at the mention of Dvorak's name?
I know. You got a problem, man. Yeah, I don't know.
I do.
Should see somebody about that. But anyway,
I call it good taste.
Fair enough. Right, whatever. Okay. So the Ninth Symphony from the New World. This is. I mean, and we can look at other people's earlier stuff, and you know, you can look at somebody like Anthony Philip Heinrich, John Knowles Payne, see like elements of American music in there, but still primarily sort of a European sound. And so here comes Dvorak, a European himself, writing definitely in a European genre. It's a symphony. It's using European stuff, but he's using American cultural and styles that are essentially kind of unique to America, and incorporating that into the symphony. And that would be the hymn style, like the second movement.
And he was doing this intentionally.
Intentionally, yes, absolutely intentionally. And you know that by the way, that hymn, that tune in the second movement, sounds so much like a hymn, American hymn tune, that we now use it as a hymn tune.
That going home.
Going home.
Going home.
Yeah.
Going home. Going home.
Something like that. All the folks I know. Yeah. It's you know about dying and seeing people. You know, that you knew in the afterlife. But anyway, people think Dvorak used the hymn in the symphony. No, he wrote that, and somebody came back and later wrote hymn words to it. Anyway, but Dvorak was good like that. He could take the essence of folk music and write original music in that style. That's, of course, what he did with, you know, Bohemian folk music, Eastern European stuff. So anyway, so and then there's other things. There's the elements of the spiritual. There's, I think, kind of cowboy song stuff in there. So there's these elements of American music that are used as the material, as the influences on the in a very art music European style genre, and so he's kind of showed the way to these European composers. Like, all right, you want to write European style art music? That's great. You can do that, but don't neglect the source material, the influences here in your own country as inspiration for that.
Huh.
And I think you can look at what Dvorak does, and then what happens with Ives, and certainly Copland later. And see that influence there. So that was a very long-winded way of saying is that we have this really kind of interesting journey with American music, and it all you know comes down to the original question: what makes it sound American? And you know, I think that's obviously something that can be. There's never a right answer for that. It's just I think it's something as American musicians, something for us to consider and to think about. So anyway,
so correct me if I'm wrong. If I remember from reading. Program notes and such about Dvorak's Ninth. I've seen it performed live a couple times, and it's very compelling, especially that last movement. It's really exciting. But I'm interested in the influences on Dvorak as he set about writing this. I don't know if I've aired my opinion of Dvorak on the show before, but I find his earlier symphonies actually much more interesting than his later symphonies.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel in his later symphonies he's more intentionally restricting himself to set forms or melodies, whether they be European or American.
Now, you say earlier, you like
his first few symphonies.
Like what he numbered 1 and 2?
Because
he...
No, what we do.
What we do,
yeah,
okay.
The ones that he never... That he didn't want to publish, I think.
Right,
yes.
Okay.
So, you know, what... so, I guess, what's old? What's the old Dvorak... Oh, what's the old Symphony number 9 number?
I think it's
five,
4.
4, okay.
4 or 5.
So, this
yeah, he
would be like
off
negative 4
half.
Through negative
yeah.
1 kind of a
yeah.
thing. Like, those... there's such interesting sounds, and surely, you know... You can hear influence from other music, but later he becomes, I guess, obsessed with this idea that the future of American music is actually based on black music, on
mm-hmm.
what he heard as these melodies, spirituals that he kind of had this affinity for. Another composer. Actually, a student of his, when Dvorak was director of the National Conservatory in New York,
yeah,
he had this student, Harry Burley, who became a composer later, said that Dvorak, Harry Burley was black. He said that Dvorak had absorbed the spirit of these melodies before he started writing his own melodies.
Right.
So if we can believe a student, of course, that's just one eyewitness account, but if we're to believe that, then you know there's I don't see how we can say that Dvorak didn't subconsciously include these melodies too. So for me, there's an interesting distinction between writing. So I guess what I'm saying is Dvorak himself was kind of an American at that point, even if he was appropriating the mm-hmm. melodies and harmonies of another culture. He saw that as the future of the music of our country.
Right.
Now, what's interesting to me is that, well, that was a very different time. What, early, late 1800s?
Yeah,
right?
Late 19th
yeah.
century.
So, at that time, things were very different in this country than they are now. But today, I find that to be almost an offensive thing.
Right, well, there's the whole question of cultural appropriation.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other thing is the Native American music. That was
right.
a big thing.
That was his other thing for the
Song of Hiawatha.
Yeah,
it's more of like the loose programmatic story. I don't know how much he tries to copy Native American sounding stuff, but we talked about this. I don't know if it was on a show or we were just talking about it, but there were certainly other composers around this same time who were what they would consider what they thought of as Native American sounding music. And incorporating into it, and I think Arthur Farwell is a composer who did that, an American. And yeah, I mean, there's stuff about that that looks pretty bad from our perspective. So, I mean, I think if you're talking about programming music like that today, and even with maybe something like the Ninth, it's important to set context and to talk about why this is the way it is, and to invite people to have conversations about the appropriateness of this and whether we should even do this music still. I think that's a big question. I think that's a question everybody has to personally. I personally have no problem programming Dvorak 9, but I can see why somebody might want to not do it because of the cultural appropriation issues. But the question about that is when does it become something that is celebrating versus something maybe the exploitation? You know, it's a tough question to ask.
I think
and
you're right.
And it's no easy answer.
That's exactly where I was going to go. Is like there's really kind of two sides to this. The one side, which is art, and we should celebrate art simply because it is art, and it is an achievement unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
the other side of it, of course, is, well, if Dvorak and other composers felt that black music was the future of the country, well, then why didn't they do more to support that music rather than to use it?
Mm.
So,
fair question.
Those are, to me, the two competing sides here. Certainly, there can be a way for them to coexist. I mean,
well, and that issue, you know, continues on,
yes.
And we can talk about another American composer, George Gershwin, Porgy and Bess. Very famous example. I did my lecture recital. It was a comparison of Porgy and Bess and William Grant Still's Troubled Island, and I delved into these issues of cultural appropriation. So, I mean, this is something that goes on, that continues to be a topic. I think the point I was making, though, is why I, you know, what I think Dvorak did do is, and I think it was productive, is it had Americans putting value, and we can talk about whether they had the right to sort of take this stuff, but to find value in the culture that was around them, you know?
Like bringing awareness to it, to a greater public, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but when you think about the nationalism of music of Europe at the time, they were doing the same thing. They were getting folk songs from, you know, out in the rural parts, and they're incorporating it. Now, this was from their own countries in large part, but not necessarily always the case. You know, Brahms wasn't Hungarian, but, you know, he had the Hungarian... He had Hungarian dances, right?
He was famous for those, yeah.
Right. So, there you go.
Yeah.
So, you know... When does it cross the line? But so I think if you think about it in that context, if he was taking a concept that was already happening in Europe and saying, "Hey, America, check out what you got,"
I see that. I acknowledge that. The issue for me, I think, is this sort of whataboutism of you know, which all sides are guilty of. I will say that, you know, if one side's accused of doing something, then the side being accused says, "Well, what about this or what about that?" You know, isn't this just as bad? Well, or isn't this the same thing? You know, this equivocating when there really isn't much. I mean, they're all different situations, right? I mean, Brahms appropriating from Hungarian cultures or Dvorak appropriating from Native American or Black culture here, they're different things because they're different things. So I think it's important to recognize, like, okay, we need to take each one on its own basis, right?
Mm-hmm.
But where does it cross the line in this case?
And I think, of course, in the conversation in America, talking about specifically music from African American music, we also have to recognize that this also has the history of minstrel show that we have to contend with as Americans, American musicians.
Not our finest moment.
Exactly. And so I think that, you know, that's an example clearly of kind of an cultural appropriation that was designed to mock and had
parody,
just
really
horrible racist aspects to
clearly
it.
Clearly racist.
I don't think, as far as I know, nothing kind of, I don't know if any Hungarians who feel that Brahms's use of his music, their music was racist. Possibly. I don't know. But
you know, I think they loved him.
Yeah.
I think they loved those dances. Yeah.
So I think.
At least in Germany.
Yeah. And I think, and I don't think anything about, I don't know Dvorak's motivation, but I don't think he was coming from the same place as the, you know, Virginia minstrels were with the minstrel show. You know, I think he was differently motivated, and it certainly doesn't have the same smack the ear of racism that you hear with some other stuff that's from other cultures. But anyway,
yeah,
this is the conversation, and it's not like here's the rule book, this is the right answer. Everybody has to kind of feel this out for themselves. But it's important that we talk about these things.
We have waded into the political sphere this week, clearly. I'll take responsibility for that. I went there.
Huh? No, it's good. No,
it's all
good.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. This is what art addresses sometimes.
Yeah, this is what we have to, I think we have to be aware of, certainly as conductors who are making programming decisions, and also in our role as communication with the audience and things like that. So, look, picking up the conversation or the chronology from kind of the Ninth Symphony and moving on, and then we get into people like Charles Ives.
Yeah.
And he, you know, is such an interesting cat, you know, and he, you know, your fellow countryman from Connecticut. By the way, you were from Hartford area?
Yep, about 10 minutes south of Hartford.
I don't know, how far is that from Danbury?
Oh.
I mean, everything's close in New England.
At most 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, right down the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mark Twain's house is about 10 minutes away.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he lived in West Hartford.
Okay. Very cool.
Yeah.
So anyway, so Charles Ives, you know, I think kind of picks up the baton a little bit from Dvorak in a big way in terms of marrying elements of vernacular tradition music with cultivated tradition art music stuff. Charles, his background, just real quick, his dad was a musician. His dad was, George Ives, was a Civil War era band leader. Huh. And after the war, continued to be a town musician. They had a town band, and he was a church musician too. And so he's well steeped in this vernacular tradition, music, religious music, like I said, folk music, town band music, and stuff like that. But then also is interested in experimentation and kind of studying music theory. George Ives was, and sort of influenced Charles in that way as well, and really got him into experimenting with bitonality and all the stuff that we associate with Charles Ives now. Mm. His dad was kind of doing that stuff. And then Charles goes off to Yale and studies with composer Horatio Parker, who is, I think he's part of the Second New England School for sure, I think. But anyway, you know, very much in that European tradition. I think he was primarily a church music composer. I don't know. Do you know Horatio Parker? Well, yeah, I think he was kind of the church music route. And I do know Ives was a church organist. So I think that would make sense. Anyway, so he gets this art music cultivated tradition. He's got the vernacular tradition from his dad, and so Ives takes this, and as we know of his music, it's really a fusion of that. And we think about the quotes of patriotic songs that he does, but it's also the way music is performed. It has this element of the vernacular, the amateur, almost intentionally sounding bad and kind of out of tune to kind of replicate the bad, out of tune church lady who doesn't know she's at off by
she hit the beat, transposition button by
half
accident.
A tone. Yeah, and she's just wailing at the top of her lung. I mean, I don't know. You know, I know that church lady. I know when I'm growing up. But anyway, so that's, but it's that kind of rough and.
Age 50.
What?
Nothing.
No. Anyway, but it's this kind of, you know, rough amateur, going back, and the whole point is going back to that kind of rough around the edges first New England school of composing. William Billings, where the guys, we're not really following the rules right, kind of sounds like, you listen to some of that stuff, and you're like, whoa, where did you come up with that harmony? That's kind of really,
that
kind
grind.
Of spicy, a little bit weird. And
it's juicy.
Yeah, exactly. A little spice there. And I can see Ives just sort of reaching back and grabbing the hand of those first New England school composers and just dragging them into the 20th century. And it's just, I don't know, it's really beautiful. They're kind of bookending the 19th century on either side there. And but anyway, I'm kind of ranting here. But I find that, you know, when we talk about what makes American music, be American and write music, that's American music. Yeah. But if I'm talking to somebody who I think doesn't just do it in kind of a kitschy way, like, oh, I'm going to quote a folk song here. You know, he does that, but it's something, he grabs the essence of American sound and of things that are American. For example, in the Third Symphony, the camp meeting, a very American kind of a event, right? The revival, tent revival thing.
Okay.
Whole symphony's based around that. So that's, to me, is like taking elements of American culture, really infusing it into it in a meaningful, deep way. So...
Can we?
There you go. That's my preaching on Ives.
Can we talk a little bit about Charles Ives and his relationship to musical movement in time?
Okay.
We started the show, I think, talking about, or at least mentioning, not Central Park in the Dark.
Unanswered question?
Yes, thank you. Of course. The unanswered question, which has how many orchestras in it?
Well, I mean, you have the strings, and that's one essential ensemble. And then you have the flutes, or it could be other woodwinds, but mostly it's always flutes. And then the trumpet is its own separate offstage kind of a thing.
So, okay. And they operate more or less, they don't operate in the way we think of as, you know, three separate groups playing together at the same time. They function really outside of each other. They're sort of really independent and not just in the notes that they play, but also the rhythms that they have and what they represent. And when I think of how that manifests to the listener, it's almost this unsettling sort of floating sense that we have with the strings.
Yes.
Right? It's just they're continually very playing. Very consonant. Just very consonant and, yeah. and really kind of hymn-like underneath everything or just happening behind everything. Sometimes they appear in front. Sometimes they appear to the side. Sometimes they're really unnoticed. Then we've got the flutes that do this fluttery, quick little thing.
Well, it gradually becomes more agitated. Mm. You know, as the trumpet keeps asking the question.
Da-da-dee.
Yeah. And then the flutes answer, and they're like, the nice little answer. And then the trumpet asks the question again. They're like, hey, you know, we said this. And they get and it says right in the score, it gets increasingly more agitated. I conducted the flutes and when I did it. That's why I get animated.
Well,
like,
no, this is where I wanted
to go.
Claudia
did the strings. I did the flutes. Yeah. And Bo is conducting the trumpet.
Oh, that's so neat.
Yeah. Anyway,
no, it all has this feeling of being very conversational, as you've really just mentioned, where it's not like a piece of music where it has a beginning and an end, and it's done, and everything in between is the piece of music. This really sort of has, if you will, a palette of, rather a canvas. Like, the strings make up this canvas of the composition, and then the flutes and the trumpet interact on top of that canvas and paint the canvas in real time. It's kind of a really a fundamentally different way of approaching composition until we get to some of the I want to say some of the second Viennese school stuff where they're kind of doing similar call and response things and bitonal things, but really who were really the first ones to do this polytonal and polyrhythmic thing on this scale? I think
Ives is kind of one of the first. Yeah. He's kind of the at least in my understanding of it. Certainly in America, I think he's the first. I don't know of many more in Europe that were experimenting with specifically with polytonal, with polyrhythmic. You know, which is what with the unanswered question is polyrhythmic for sure. The bar lines don't line up, which is why you need at least two conductors, three, you know, if you got it.
Well, thank you. The bar lines don't line up.
Yeah, no,
it doesn't. They literally don't connect on the page.
I don't know if anybody ever conducts it with one person at a time. I mean, you could kind of let the flutes kind of maybe take care of themselves and let the flutes lead.
Well, I think that's the idea, too, is it's not supposed to sound together. In fact, I think he writes in the score that they're not... These notes are not strictly together.
No.
They must have some natural push and pull by the nature of their not being together.
Right. You want to make sure you kind of start it like the trumpet asks the question and, of course, the flutes follow. So there is a, you know, that has to line up. And when I was conducting it, I was following a pace where the strings were. Because like you said, they're the canvas and all this is happening above it. So you do have to follow it. But, yeah, it's not strictly have to be in line. The other thing about this piece I wanted to mention before we move on, something else, is that it's also experimentation and setup about having ensembles in different places. I mean, there's been off stage before. I mean, that's not anything new. They did that in opera, but I think Ives was kind of getting more into that experimentation with where the sound is actually coming from. So,
The only others that I can think of in the European tradition anyway are some of the Italians who did that antiphonal thing, like Gabrielli was known for that.
Yeah,
much earlier, of course. I wonder if that influenced Ives at all.
Probably.
And then I also wonder if I can make a big jump.
Go for it.
At least briefly. I wonder how much that kind of rhythmic fluidity and tempo fluidity influenced the early minimalists and later minimalists, especially the Americans.
You know, I don't know about Ives and influence on minimalism.
Like, I'm thinking, you know, Terry Riley and Reich and later Adams.
I think when I think of Ives' influence, I think it more in the kind of the people like John Cage, the aleatoric composers that come along later.
Yeah. Tone clusters.
Yes. Ives did tone clusters.
Oh, I love that.
I see you have Henry Cowell out here.
I do.
He was a tone cluster guy.
Not so much in this one.
Well, his piano works, I'm thinking of.
Did Ives invent that notation?
Pardon?
Did Ives invent that notation where you have like the black bar from top to bottom from one note head to another, where it just basically means every note in between is played?
No, I don't know who invented that.
I don't know either.
I don't know. So, but anyway, but yeah, Ives, I think, is, we can kind of point to him as the granddaddy of the experimentalists. In my American music textbook that I use, it's arranged by kind of genres. It's sort of chronological, but then it hits genres. And Ives is the first thing in the experimental section. Something else I want to mention about Ives, and this I think is kind of an American experience too, and most musicians know this, but maybe more people who aren't you know, professional musicians may not have ever picked this up about Ives, is he was primarily an insurance salesman as his job.
That was his day job.
And he actually was quite a rock star, and apparently in insurance, he...
he was fairly wealthy, if I recall.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, it's why they call it a day job, right?
Yeah.
He was, I think he's sort of like the grandfather of, or one of the early pioneers in estate planning or something like that with life insurance. Lucky. I don't know. But
good for him.
And he wrote a book about insurance and made a lot of money that way. So he was a big deal in the insurance world. And then people were like, oh, yeah, and he writes music on the weekends or something like that. And then later in his life, fortunately before he died, he did get really fully recognized by the world as a composer. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his Third Symphony, by the way, in 47. He died in 54, I think. And so he did get that recognition. But it was a hobby.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of was a hobby for him. Yeah. And you know.
Thanks, Ives. Not helping anybody here.
Huh?
He's not helping any musicians make a
living. Well, yeah. We hope that the Ives model is not what's required for everybody. But
unfortunately, that's kind of the American model.
I don't know much about insurance. But anyway.
Yeah.
But like it's interesting. And like and he was just like kind of happy people were playing his music. He was like, oh, okay. You know, come on over to the house this weekend. We'll do some piano music or whatever. But anyway, I just thought he's a very fascinating character. And I, you know, there's a wonderful group of American composers, but he's always been kind of my favorite. Not necessarily like his music is my favorite, although I certainly do love it. I guess kind of like his, what he was all about as a composer. I love that kind of marrying of the cultivated and the vernacular. I love the experimentation and it was all about kind of the emotion and the passion of music. And he didn't care if it was, you know, perfectly written, followed all the rules, like kind of like that first New England school of composers. He wanted the music to be passionate. Yes. And there's a famous quote from him about that. Like he'd rather hear a passionate performance done kind of bad, you know, without every note being perfect, than a perfectly in tune, everything was exactly right, but doesn't have that juice to it. So anyway, we can move on from Ives. Ives has dominated the show so far, but...
that's never a bad thing. You know, to be honest, it took me a long time to come around to Ives.
Well, me too. I think that's true for a lot of people.
Music really, you know... Yeah, okay, yeah. So I think that's a common... You know, we're just so used to hearing a certain thing that eventually it becomes what we associate to be good.
Yeah.
Or appropriate. And we don't think of it that way. It's just what we're exposed to, and that's what we become used to, and our brains are plastic and they associate what's familiar with what's good because it's comfortable. It's an evolutionary thing. It's a survival thing.
And they think that his music is all like, oh, it's all dissonant, it's crazy, it's multi-tonality and multi-rhythms, but he can write some of the most beautiful harmonic, tonal, consonant, just glorious sounding music. But the thing is, it's like he uses it not because he has to write that way. He can write this really dissonant stuff to express something, and then when he needs to use beautiful consonant harmonies and, you know, simpleness, he can do that too. Like I'm thinking of the end of the Third Symphony. It's the third movement's called Communion, and it has this like really ramped up build up, and it's really kind of intense and really thick harmonies and a lot of dissonance, and then it just slowly dissolves into this beautiful like hymn-like ending, and then you hear the church bells at the end, and it's just like
glorious.
It's beautiful. I mean, that's what I also like about his music. He didn't say, oh, I have to write atonal, and everything's got to be atonal. Everything's got to be experimental. This can be experimental, but then later it can be more traditional if that's what helps express what he wants to do. I don't like it when sort of people, and my opinion is, I like it when people feel freed to write what they want. They don't get sort of boxed in by a technique.
Yeah.
I think when you get boxed in by a technique, you get a little... boxed in.
That's right.
So anyway,
certainly. I mean, that's one way. That's just one way to do it, right?
Yeah.
To do anything really is, you know, to set with a stick with a set form, and to stay traditional, I suppose, is one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is, well, anything's on the table.
Yeah.
That can really bug people, especially if they're not used to that. If they're not used to challenging the limits of what they know.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing that being played out in a lot of ways in the world.
Yeah.
Not especially right now, always, but especially right now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so you got some other scores there. What else you got, Matt? I've been kind of doing a lot of hives.
No, I mean, I just have this one piece that I think is interesting. Henry Cowell's Synchrony, which was published, I believe, in the early 30s, 1930s. This was a collaboration. This was meant to be danced to. This is not necessarily incidental music. What I mean by that, it's not accompanying the dance.
Right.
This is this piece represents a relatively unique way of approaching composition because it incorporates the choreographer as well. Cowell actually intended to collaborate with Martha Graham, who we know as the famous choreographer of Appalachian Spring. And she and Henry worked together to create a new kind of counterpoint. And let me first explain. Counterpoint, as we know it in music, is strictly a melodic feature of the music. It's literally point against point, note against note, that has to obey certain rules or follow certain patterns. Like Bach is famous for his counterpoint in the fugues and inventions and whatnot. Counterpoint in this instance refers to the music as a whole, and it's playing against the choreography, the dancing as a whole. So it's fascinating how this works, because while this was never completed as a ballet or as any dance, the music exists. We have the music, and we can imagine from what we know about Cowell's writings and correspondence with Martha Graham. Henry Cowell was in prison at the time.
Yeah.
Because being gay at that time was more or less illegal in California, and so he had been suspected of certain activities and was basically dragged out of his house and sent to prison.
Yeah, and we should also point out, this was in the 20th century. We're not in the 19th century anymore, just a little...
Correct. This is
still happening in the 20th century. So. Yeah. Anyway.
In California.
Yeah.
So, not too long ago, yeah. And so from what we understand it from his correspondence between he and Martha, that they intended, for instance, by example, there's a loud part in the music, then the dance would do something kind of quiet and subtle. If there was a really busy, loud moment in the dancing, and then the music would complement that in the opposite again. So there was this inverse relationship between the dancing and the music. That was what they considered to be this counterpoint. And some of the notes that he's made in his copy of the score are kind of revealing, because you can tell that the piece was composed at the same time that the dancing was choreographed, and that they've spoken about certain passages and how they want the choreography to go with the music and vice versa. For instance, Cowell writes on rehearsal number 24, in case you have the score and you're interested, he writes, "Hold long, add moving harmonies." And then he crossed that out, and then he amended it to say, "Change the scoring, the dance is fast." So you can see like the evolution of the thought here in terms of the composing. It wasn't done just to highlight the dance or to accompany the dance. It was actually, the dancing is an integral part of the musical composition, and the music was an integral part of the choreography at the
same
time.
So they were making decisions jointly as the piece was being brought forward. It's correct. Not like, here's some music, write a dance to it, or vice versa.
Think about the Nutcracker, right? They're, we just had Christmas. Tchaikovsky wrote the Nutcracker, and then it was choreographed.
Right.
And that's how it was done, most of the time. The vast majority of the time. Not in this case. And so they both, I think it's notable, since this show is about American music, that they both were trying to achieve what they thought of as something uniquely American. To them, this was being an this was writing American music and creating American choreography, was doing this kind of counterpoint. This collaboration represents that, yeah. So I think it's fascinating.
It is, you know. Henry Cowell is another one that I really find as a fascinating experimentalist. This is not orchestral music, but you know he was famous for a lot of his playing directly on the piano strings, like with his piano music. I think like the Banshee, where he scrapes the lower strings that have the wound wire, and then strums. some on the strings, and then of course the tone clusters. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I am
using the forearm to play the piano. Yeah,
yeah, the experimental wing, and you know, there's plenty of experimentation happening in Europe, but I think another thing that sort of is the essence of American in the 20th century is this kind of like future looking. Let's push and try new things. We were trying new things in terms of technology. We were new in terms as a, you know, relative to Europe as a country. So this kind of newness and trying new things sort of has a feel of and flavor of America. And then, of course, somebody like John Cage really takes that experimentation trajectory and just like shoots off into the sky with it, all the way up to Silence, you know, where the music is everything and nothing.
Wait, I'm going to compose a piece right now.
And it's made up of trucks.
Yeah, did you hear that?
Cars.
Cars going by?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, that's the idea. We could go down the rabbit hole with 433 or Silence, as it's, I think it's his official name. But anyway, I the experimentalist side. But let's before we wrap up, because we're about an hour, and the sun is getting low.
Yes, it's getting a little chilly.
Let's take a turn to the more traditional. Let's talk about Copland.
Okay.
You know, and when people think American composers, they probably think of Copland first, maybe Duke Ellington right there after that. I certainly do. But Copland, you know, the American sound.
Bernstein.
Yeah. You know, that American. And Copland, if you look at his whole career, I mean, he did work in a lot of different styles. I think he did 12-tone, right? He did 8-tone.
Yeah, later, I think, in his life. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, but what he's famous for is this sort of middle period, right around the war years. And there was a thing called the Federal Music Project, which is part of the WPA as a result of the New Deal, which helped fund and support a lot of growth of American music. And I think Copland was part of that and got some commissions. I'm pretty sure Fanfare of the Common Man was actually a government commission.
I believe that's correct.
So there is a certain element of sort of the war effort that's in some of this American music, but also sort of the celebration of American life. And you know, when I think of what kind of gives Copland that American sound, I think it kind of boils down to me to wide-spaced intervals.
Hmm.
And so when I just drove across the country, right, from the east out here, and when you're driving through Nebraska, it is just wide open. I mean, you could just see forever. Huh?
That's a good point.
And there's this literal largeness and openness of space. And he kind of captures that wide openness of space that we associate with the American West, particularly with these wide-spaced intervals.
I think it's that
bigness of the intervals. The notes are separated. You know, they're leaping sometimes. Sometimes they're sustained chords. But the fact that these intervals are wide-spaced kind of speaks to the largeness, especially of the American West. So that's my kind of how I feel, or what I kind of interpret that kind of American Copland-y sound. Because, you know, I mean, he does quote, I mean, of course, famously in Appalachian Spring, he quotes the Shaker hymn, Simple Gifts. I don't know, does he quote anything else in Appalachian Spring? I don't think so.
It's a lot of long notes.
Yeah, but he, yeah, right. But he kind of has, like, kind of like Dvorak did, he has kind of folky sounding stuff in some other pieces, like Rodeo, you know, kind of the cowboy, you know, cowboy sounding stuff. But the essence of it, really, I think, is this sense of largeness in his music and size, and that's those wide space intervals. So, anyway, that's my crackpot theory. What are your thoughts on Copland?
Oh, where to begin? Well, it's too bad McKeever's not here, because we could have a whole show about what we think about the Third Symphony.
That's true. We've already done that, though.
Yeah, I guess
we've done that show. Yeah. It's number episode 7.
I don't know. I really, really love some of Copland's music, and I really don't love some of it too.
Well, give me the list.
Okay,
give me the good list and the bad list.
Some of the old American songs are just lovely.
And you did those recently, right?
I did a couple.
Yeah,
yep. Back in the fall, with one of my groups. Let's see here. What else? Fanfare for the Common Man. You know, I don't love it.
Mm-hmm.
It's to me, it's lacking something, especially the end. And I'm not quite sure how to describe that, other than just
it's certainly not lacking timpani at the end.
No, it's not. it's just I don't know. I think Rodeo is great. I think Appalachian Spring has beautiful moments. That's all I'm going to say about Copland.
Okay. So let's, speaking of Appalachian Spring, you were talking full version versus original.
Yeah, smaller. I think I prefer the lighter, the smaller version. It's just too. A bit more transparent, and
I like fun. The piano.
Yeah, the piano is beautiful.
I think the piano part is. I just love that. I love those notes on the piano.
Yeah.
With Copland, I'm probably more of a more up on Copland. I certainly don't, people call him the Dean of American Music, and that's, you know, he certainly worked his butt off and became a famous composer for a good reason. I think I would argue, I would give the deanship to Duke Ellington if I were had my choice. But
what about Louis Armstrong?
Well, you know, Louis Armstrong, I don't know how much actual composition?
Joplin.
Scott Joplin?
I mean, if we're talking influential, but necessarily compositional.
The volume of work that Duke Ellington did, and the fact that he did work in, you know, kind of the traditional jazz genre, the big band, and then the symphonic pieces and the hybrid pieces like Harlem and... the other name just left my head. Black and Tan Fanta? No, that's one of his big... Three Black Kings. That's the one I was thinking. Anyway, but, you know, he just... You know, he had chops, man.
Yeah.
He had chops in a lot of different areas. So I think that makes you the dean. You can do a lot of stuff. You're not just over here in this department.
Okay.
You're here in this department. You're here in that department. That's why Ellington gets to be the dean.
So Joplin was the department head.
Joplin was the chair of the ragtime department. You know, Louis Armstrong was chair of, like, abstracting pop melodies and turning them into amazing vocals and solos. But anyway, Ellington, I don't know. But I'm digressing from. I want to talk about Copland.
Yeah.
But I think what I like so much about Copland is that kind of American sound, and I do like the fact that his music is something that you can hook people into some more modern music, more experimental stuff. I think it's good for programming that way. And yeah, not everything is great. He did an opera called Tenderland, which has some wonderful moments. Is it the best American opera out there? No. I wouldn't say that at all. But Quiet City. There's an example of a great small piece that I feel just has this gorgeous sound to it.
I adore that piece.
That is so beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It almost seems
like it's a different composer.
Well, thank us. As we were saying, like, he's multiple composers. I mean, when people think of Copland, they're thinking of the Americanism. They're thinking of the three ballets, Appalachian Spring, mm-hmm. Billy the Kid, and Rodeo. As they get into Fanfare for the Common Man, maybe Outdoor Overture. Mm-hmm. That's another one. Lincoln Portrait, of course. But he was a lot more than that. So we shouldn't sort of just judge him on that alone. But I do think his music is quite quite good and still very much relevant. And so I'm going to say nicer things about Copland. Okay,
that was nice.
Okay, he's a good guy.
He's a good guy.
He's all right. And. you know, he was a conductor too, so we should say that. He didn't do a lot of conducting until his later years, I think.
Have you ever watched Stravinsky conduct?
Stravinsky?
Yeah.
No.
It's hilarious.
Now, the one to watch is Strauss. You ever watch Strauss conduct? Yeah. It's like he's dead.
It's like he's dead.
Yeah. Like he may have been dead. I don't know. Could have dug him up and just put him up there with on the arm.
If Mike Pence took up conducting.
Hello. There you go. I don't know if Mother would let him do conducting. But anyway. So anyway, what was I saying? So other American composers that I want to give a shout out to. Of course,
Bernstein.
William Grant's, huh?
Bernstein.
Bernstein. Okay, we talk about Bernstein. What do you got to say about Bernstein?
No, I just wanted to give a shout out.
Oh, hey, yeah. Hey. Shout out to Bernstein. Yeah. Okay.
You know, I saw his grave.
Did you know?
Yeah, in New York, in Brooklyn, a couple summers ago.
Yeah.
Cannot remember the name of the cemetery. It's a large private cemetery in Brooklyn, site of one of the early Revolutionary War battles. I think it's Brooklyn Hill or something.
Oh, okay, sure.
But yeah, that's where he's buried. Beautiful grave. It was a moving experience.
Yeah. I saw Dvorak's grave, your favorite, in Prague, and then Smetana's also. That's the composer. And then, well, of course, I went to Vienna. I saw Brahms and Beethoven and Schubert.
Did you go to the Red Hedgehog?
I didn't go to the Red Hedgehog. I didn't know about the Red Hedgehog at the time. This was a long time ago. But no, the Bernstein graves have been cool to see. But the other composer I was going to say is William Grant Still. who I think doesn't get as much play. I mean, people know Afro-American Symphony. Panamanian Dances, by the way, it's a great string piece.
Oh, I love it.
If people are out there looking for string orchestra music, as a lot of our orchestras are doing strings only, which I am, that's a great one. But anyway, there's all kinds of different great music by William Grant Still. So we have a rich tradition in this country that we really got to be proud of. And Matt, you look like you're about to pass out like freeze to death. So we got to wrap this up. Any final thoughts on American music before you turn into a popsicle?
Yeah, just that it's not all about, you know, military tunes and marches and all these hymns and stuff. There's a lot of really great, rich American music out there that people don't know about.
Yeah.
Let's do some hunting out there, folks.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And like I said, take a look at some of the symphonic work of Ellington. That's my pitch. Is that the bell that's supposed to end the show?
That's the dinner bell.
The dinner bell? Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, we've reached the point of Matt's going into hyperthermia. So we're going to sign off, Matt. It's been good to be back with you, my friend. And we'll be back next week. If you like it, subscribe, tune into us next week. And we'll be back for another edition of Conductor's Brew. Thanks, everybody.
Cheers.